opinions expressed on the following program do not necessarily reflect those of staff and management of WBIG Radio. The Big One, AM 1280 WBIG presents People to People, a daily news interview hosted by WBIG News Director Ron Newman. People to People features candid conversation with area newsmakers and community leaders and your telephone calls. You can join today's program by dialing 585-1280, area code 630-585-1280. Now today, People to People, and your host, Ron Newman.
And good morning. It's 16 minutes after 8 o'clock on Monday, March 17th, St. Patrick's Day. As we told you last week, we are presenting a five-day series on the Federal Reserve. And today, a most important show. I would suggest running a tape on this one. As a matter of fact, it wouldn't be a bad idea maybe to get yourself some 90-minute cassettes and record all five of this week's shows, and Monday from May 15 to 9 as well. On the air with me this morning by telephone from sunny California is a gentleman by the name of G. Edward Griffin. G-R-I-F-F-I-N. The topic of today's conversation to kick off Federal Reserve Week is the subject of his book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, a second book at the Federal Reserve. Ed, good morning. It's a pleasure talking with you this morning.
Good morning, Ron. It's a pleasure being on your show.
I have heard so much, really, about you. I know that you are the author of several books. You are also one of these people that just doesn't go off half-cocked about a subject. You, if necessary, you have gone out and gotten educated in certain subjects and become, you even became a certified financial planner in order to, in part, write this book called The Creature of Jekyll Island so that you might understand the process a little better. And it's just... Not many authors. You know, a lot of authors will investigate maybe a certain subject. Even novel writers, you know, fiction writers will investigate a certain topic before they write on it so that they sound credible in the book. But you are absolutely amazing, Ed. I mean, you've written factual books on a variety of subjects, and you study these things very thoroughly before you put the pen to paper. And I think that's very unusual as far as authors go. Typically, they usually stick with, you know, maybe one or two subjects, but you're really all over the board. You talk about so many different things, it's incredible.
Yeah, I'm pretty schizophrenic in that.
Well, you know, if you're going to present a side of the story, no matter what side you come down on, you've got to know what you're talking about, and I believe that you do.
Well, thank you, Ron. It's important to me because, as you know, most of the topics that I do write about are what I would consider to be upstream topics, in that they are going contrary to the mainstream of popular opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So when you take that position, you better be prepared for some stiff opposition, people who find what you're saying to be incredible, and that's fair. You know, they're going to say, I've never heard that before. I don't believe that. Prove that. So you have to be a very defensive type of researcher when you tackle a project like that.
So I want to get into the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, the second book at the Federal Reserve. This is actually... I think the copy that I have, Ed, is the 12th printing.
The 12th?
Yes.
Oh.
The first edition came out in July of 1994.
Uh-huh.
And that's when it was... And I guess you've had up to 12 printings, and perhaps even more by now, is that right?
Yes, but the current one is the 14th printing.
The 14th?
Yes,
Wow. Well,
so it keeps bubbling along.
Yes,
much to my amazement, Ron, because you know when I wrote this thing, it's a big book. I thought, well, nobody wants to read about the Federal Reserve System, and they'll think it's a very dull topic. And I remember looking at my wife that morning and saying, Pat, what have I done to get this, all these books? We're going to have a garage full of books for the rest of our lives. But much to my amazement and delight, people are interested, and we just keep printing more printings.
Well, if I may say so, the book may be a lot of things. It may be big, but it's certainly not dull. And I find it personally quite hard to put down. I'm disappointed when I have to close the book and finally turn out the light. But
thank you.
You know. First of all, let me ask you something very briefly here, Ed. What prompted you to write the book to begin? What made you really decide to write about the Federal Reserve, of all the different things that you could have talked about?
Well, that's probably the least important or least interesting part of this story, because it's very dull. There was no single event, Ron. It's just that many, many years ago, and I don't even remember how long, I had decided that I wanted to write a documentary film on inflation. That was my business, you know, to do documentary films. I thought inflation would be a very interesting one and an important one. So I started to do some research. This was probably back in the early 70s, I would guess. And I got a box full of research material and got halfway into it and never did finish it, never did produce the film, because other things came along that seemed to be more important. But then many years later, someone asked me to give a presentation before a local group here on the subject of taxes. And I said, well, you know, I'm not really an expert on taxes. My opinion about taxes is that they're too high and I'm a ginnam. What else do you want to know? And they said, well, more than that. So I said, well, I'll tell you what, I've got a box full of research on the Federal Reserve System, and that inflation, of course, is a hidden tax. You want me to talk about that? They said, sure. Of course, they were looking for a speaker. They didn't care what I talked about so much. So I committed to it and got my box out. And when I got my nose back into it, I thought, uh-oh, I'm way not prepared to talk on this topic. So that threw me back into further reading. And to make a long story short, I gave the presentation. It was extremely well received by the group there, and the people were kind enough to encourage me to take the show on the road, I think as one person put it. So that encouraged me, and I went back and picked up the research trail, and the rest of it is history. From that point forward, it took me about 7 years.
Wow.
So it's a very difficult thing to unravel. Like so many of the things I get into, there's an appearance on the surface that, you know, we all think we understand this pretty well because there's a conventional wisdom about it. But when you start digging, you soon discover that, wait a minute, the reality is quite different from the image. So when you get into something like the Federal Reserve System, of course, it puts the fear of God into you, because you think, gee, this is a very technical topic. I better be careful. I probably am not smart enough to figure this out. Well, it turns out that you don't have to be that smart. You just have to be persistent. And usually what you find out is that there's a lot of smoke and mirrors in a topic like this, which is certainly true in the Federal Reserve System. There's a lot of smoke and mirrors there.
Well, let's
go. The principles are really quite simple.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. Now, I think that most people have probably heard that there was supposed to be some kind of a secret meeting, ultra secret, and that they met on this place called Jekyll Island, which is off the coast of Georgia, and that all these men, I believe there were seven of them, got together and conspired, if you will, to form, I guess, what ultimately became the Federal Reserve. And this was, like I say, this was all done with a great degree, a very high level of secrecy. And I just wondered how much of what I've said so far is actually true, Ed.
Well, it's all 100% true. The only question some people might raise is on the word conspiracy. I have no trouble with that word, although a lot of us have been programmed to have a knee-jerk reaction as though conspiracies never exist. Some people think that conspiracies are like ghosts, that some people believe in them and others don't. But, you know, it's not provable either way. That's not true. History is full of conspiracies. And in fact, the engine of history is driven primarily by conspiracies. But regardless of what word you want to choose, one of the participants, at least, at that meeting, did describe it as a conspiracy himself. And it's pretty clear that the people who went there considered it to be a conspiracy. Conspiracy roughly being defined as an act which is illegal or immoral and done in secret. Well, these people probably didn't think that what they were doing was illegal or immoral, but I think most of the rest of the world would consider it to be so. You know, it's a question of reference. They thought they were probably doing a good thing. But they did understand that what they were doing would not be well received by the general population, which is why they had to engage in great secrecy.
I wonder if, before we take our first break here at the bottom of the hour in 4 minutes, if you can tell us how they pulled this off. Well, let's start maybe by telling the people who these seven individuals were. And I guess they jumped on a train. They all got on a train in New Jersey. And maybe tell us how they pulled this off there in New Jersey and where they went. Now, this was back in 1910. Tell the audience what happened.
Yeah, that's right. It was November of 1910. And these seven men that you mentioned were given instructions, confidential instructions, to gather very quietly and unnoticeably at the New Jersey Railroad Station, where a private railroad car had been docked there, ready to be coupled to the tail end of a train that would go to the south.
Now, whose railroad car was that?
That was owned by Senator Nelson Aldrich, who was a very prominent and powerful Republican senator at the time. He was called the Whip of the Senate. He was a very wealthy man. As you can imagine, having your own private railroad car would be like having your own Learjet today. So he was the one that, as far as we know, he's the one that gave the invitation, which was more than an invitation. It was instructions, really, because it was backed by the authority of J.P. Morgan and the Rockefeller Group. That was, as you'll see in a moment, these are the people that came there. And they were instructed to come one at a time, as unobtrusively as possible, not to be seen together, not to dine together, even though they all knew each other, and to avoid newspaper reporters at all costs. One of them even came with a big shotgun in a big black case. So in case someone, some reporter or someone, had spotted him and asked him where he was going, he was prepared to say that he was going on a duck hunting trip, which is very funny because we find out later from his children and his biographers that this man never fired a gun in his life, didn't own a gun. That was a borrowed shotgun, just for the purposes of decoy and deception. And once they got on the private railroad car, they were instructed not to address each other by their last names, to address each other by first names only. And in the case of two of those men, they even dropped their first names and adopted code names.
You know what?
In the privacy of this car.
You know what? This almost sounds like a bunch of 11 or 12-year-olds that had their own little private club, and they all have little secret code names, and they're not supposed to use their last name. This story, in fact, the way you lay it out in your book, the creature from Jekyll Island, is the most bizarre story that I personally have ever heard. The level that these men went to protect their identities.
Well, you see, Ron, they had something to protect more than their identities.
Yeah, but they were all businessmen. What? I guess the only thing that makes this whole thing so strange is that you did acknowledge that, oh yeah, they knew each other, but the odd thing was they were all competitors with one another.
Yes, they were. And that was part of the essence of the meeting, and that's a great clue as to why they were there and what they accomplished. You see, back to the secrecy before we let go of that.
Mm-hmm. Now,
what they were concerned about is that the servants on board the train might pick up on who they all were. And even though they were pledged to great secrecy, the servants were not. And they were afraid that the servants might talk and that the word might get out that these well-known people had all been together and went to a meeting in Jekyll Island. Then they thought, well, if the word got out, it would be devastating in the markets of Paris and London and New York and elsewhere. So absolute secrecy had to be maintained. And the reason for that, now let's get right to the chase.
All right.
Is what they were doing was they were drafting some legislation which was going to be offered to the American people as a solution to a problem. The American public at that time was greatly concerned over the concentration of financial power into the hands of a small group in Wall Street, which they, in those days, called the Money Trust. That was kind of the nickname given to it in the newspapers. The Money Trust in Wall Street was very dangerous, and there was a great cry to break the grip of the Money Trust, and the proposed legislation was going to be offered supposedly to break the grip of the Money Trust. Well, the legislation was being written by the Money Trust, you see. Had the public known that this legislation, which was being offered as a solution, was being drafted by the people that were the cause of the problem, why, it would never have been accepted, and that was the reason the secrecy had to be maintained all the way up and down the line.
You see, that's the interesting thing. They knew that if they were to be revealed as the drafters of this legislation, that number one, the people wouldn't have bought it. They wouldn't have bought into it. And secondly, Congress itself would not have bought into it.
Absolutely.
So
that's like asking the, you know, the fox to build the hen house and install the security system.
Well, how did they get around this big obstacle? They must have said, look, we can't go about it this way, so we have to put our heads together to find an end run around this to get it looked as if this is something legitimate, it's something good, it's going to help the people, and then present it to Congress that way. We're going to take a short break, and we'll let Ed Griffin explain that. Ed Griffin, the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, a second look at the Federal Reserve here on Federal Reserve Week on The Big One, AM 1280 WBIG. We'll be back in 1 minute. Welcome back. It's 8:33 and a half on Monday, March 17th. My guest, G. Edward Griffin. Ed, welcome back.
Thank you.
Before the break, we talked about the fact that, you know, if these seven gentlemen, who I would like you to list, by the way, had they gotten together and proposed this in front of Congress and to the American people, they never would have bought into it. So they, before they presented it, they had to find a way to, repackage it, you know, make it look real pretty, make it attractive so that they could maybe kind of, I guess maybe the word would be fool Congress, fool the people into thinking that this was a good thing. How did they perform this end run around the truth to repackage this proposal they wanted to
do? Yeah, that's a good way to approach it, Ron. At your suggestion, though, let me just tell you briefly who these seven people were.
All right.
So we can appreciate who is the mastermind here. The first one we've already mentioned, that was Nelson Aldridge, who was the senator, the Republican, who owned a railroad car. The reason he was a key figure here is because he was the chairman of what was called the National Monetary Commission, and that was the special committee of Congress that was given the job of proposing legislation to break the grip of the Money Trust. Now, it's interesting to know that he was a close business associate of J.P. Morgan. He was the father-in-law to John D. Rockefeller, Jr. So you see, he's just the kind of guy to break the grip of the Money Trust.
Mm-hmm.
The second one was about the only person with political connection. He was Abraham P.S. Andrew. He was the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury at that time. But that doesn't really describe him very well, because his real power was the connections on Wall Street. He was he had banking connections, and that's where most of his life was spent. But at this moment in history, he was the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. The third person was Frank Vanderlip. He was the president of the National City Bank of New York. That was the most powerful of all the banks at that time, and it represented the financial interests of William Rockefeller and the international investment banking house at Kuhn Loeb & Company. The fourth person on board that train that day, or that week, one day up and one day back, and then 6 days on Jekyll Island, was Henry P. Davison. He was the senior partner of the J.P. Morgan Company. Charles Norton was there. He was the president of J.P. Morton's First National Bank of New York, another one of the giants. Benjamin Strong was there. He was the head of J.P. Morgan's Bankers Trust Company. And finally, the man who is probably the greatest strategist of them all, and the most knowledgeable in banking, especially as it existed in Europe, was Paul Warburg. Warburg was a naturalized American citizen. He was born in Germany. He was head of J.P. Morgan's, he was a partner in Kuhn Globin Company, and he was a representative of the Rothschild banking dynasty in England and France. And, of course, his brother was Max Warburg. He maintained a very close liaison with Max, who was the head of the Warburg Banking Consortium in Germany and the Netherlands. Now, the interesting thing about that list is that according to the literature of the time, written by people who were friends of this group, they estimated that this group of people represented, directly or indirectly, approximately one-fourth of the wealth of the entire world.
Just these seven men?
Yes. Represented approximately one-fourth of the wealth of the entire world. Now, if there was ever a group that would be the epitome of the money trust, it was this group, you see. Not just they themselves, but the organizations which they represented directly and indirectly. So that's the group that we're talking about, and they are the ones who masterminded the Federal Reserve System, which was later sold to the American people as a means of breaking the grip of the money trust. So you can see why the secrecy. In fact, several of them in later years wrote very openly about it. You see, another interesting thing about this is that for quite a while after this meeting, these men denied that the event ever took place. No, never happened. It's a myth, they said. Only later, after the Federal Reserve was established by law, that was in 1913, which was 3 years later, and then even later than that, when it became accepted in the public mind as a great American institution of some kind, then and only then did they begin to speak openly about the fact that, yes, there was a meeting and they took part in it, and then they began to sort of compete with each other to see, they were claiming to have the most influence at this meeting. And it was at that stage in history that they began to write books, their biographers began to publish about it. One of them even wrote a lengthy article that appeared in the Saturday Evening Post that was Frank Vanderlip. And so now it's possible many years later to go to any well-stocked library and you can read in great detail, written by the men themselves, exactly what happened on that island at that meeting and why they did it. Now, you raised a very interesting question before, and then how did they pull this off? This is a trick. I guess we'll call it a trick. It's a maneuver. It's a ploy. It's a stratagem, whatever word you like, that is quite common in political circles. Even today, the idea is you know that there's a problem coming. You know that the public is going to demand a solution to the problem, so don't wait for the public to solve the problem. You run to the head of the line and lead your own opposition. You start being the most outspoken person, saying all the things that the public is saying, and you yourself become the leader of this movement to supposedly solve the problem, when in reality what you're trying to do is to make sure that the problem is not solved, or at least it's solved only partially, so that you can still maintain control. This is what they were doing. They knew the public wanted reform in banking. So rather than wait for a real reform movement to generate, they decided to lead the reform movement themselves, so they would be to their advantage. It's a trick that's used over and over and over again in politics. And whenever you hear politicians advocating some kind of reform, supposedly in the interest of the people, you better have your eyes open and have a couple of cups of coffee in you and start reading the fine print, because more often than not, the legislation is eyewash, and what it's really doing is protecting some special interest group that's behind it.
Let me break in here for just a second and put a caller on hold. Caller, hang on, we'll get right to you, okay?
Okay.
All right. 585-1280. We are not going to spend a lot of time taking phone calls, obviously, because Ed Griffin's book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, including the pictures and the index, is 608 pages long. You are not going to sit and read this in one evening. And it's a lot of ground to cover. We're going to cover more. How would you like to talk to one of my listeners?
Fine.
All right, let's bring him in. And I believe it's Bob from Elgin. Say hello to G. Edward Griffin.
Good morning.
Bob.
The quick question I have, and then I'll go. Could you explain if there was any involvement in this of the Rothschild family of Europe?
The Rothschild family was very interested in this event. You cannot find any good, clear historical documents to show that the Rothschilds deliberately determined the policy of this meeting. However, I mentioned that Kuhn, Loeb & Company was a representative of the Rothschild financial interests. Also, it's a not well-known fact of history, but pretty well documented, that J.P. Morgan operated as a front for the Rothschilds. Morgan's fortune came from England, and the only reason that J.P. Morgan and his firm became a dominant financial force in the United States is that they survived some periods of depression when most of their competitors fell by the wayside or were greatly weakened. At that time, they got tremendous infusions of fresh capital from the Bank of England and from the Rothschild Group. J.P. Morgan was always very close to the Rothschilds, and it was widely considered by people in the markets at that time that he really was their agent, although the Rothschilds, as you know, for reasons which are steeped in anti-Semitism in Europe, the Rothschilds had learned long earlier in their career to operate through agents who were not well known to be associated with them, because it was, you know, it was to their financial advantage. And even J.P. Morgan himself often was considered to be anti-Semitic, and this, of course, was just perfect for the illusion that he was not connected with the Rothschilds at all. But anyway, to answer your question, the Rothschilds clearly were deeply involved in the Federal Reserve movement in the United States, probably had some money involved in the banks in the United States that became the first members. But it cannot be proven with documentation that they participated in any way, in any direct way, in the formation of the Federal Reserve.
Well, I appreciate your insight, because you know, the thing when I studied their involvement in Europe, you know, there was the number of sons of Nathan Rothschild, and he had a son virtually in each country.
Yes.
And this is how they created a banking circle, and it's an interesting study in the growth of banking power. But thanks a lot for your book.
You're very welcome.
Bob, thanks for it, and we hope you will take time to pick up a copy of the book. It is called The Creature from Jekyll Island. Jekyll is spelled J-E-K-Y-L-L. A Second Look at the Federal Reserve. It's interesting to note, and I just found this so, for some reason I found it fascinating. Jekyll Island isn't some mysterious thing that nobody knows where it is. I mean, it's right there. It's just off the coast of Georgia. And in fact, it is now owned by the state of Georgia. The very building, this big clubhouse that these seven men met in back in 1910, still exists. It's now open to the public. Most, if not all, the buildings are little cottages, if you will, which is an interesting story in itself, are still there. And people can go see it to this day, and they even mention, I guess there's a plaque on the door of that big clubhouse that said this was the birthplace of the Federal Reserve, or words to that effect.
That's right. There's no great secrecy about it, even though it's not well known. In fact, a lot of material that I used in my book I got from the archives. The historian right there on Jekyll Island are very cooperative, and they have a lot of great original material in their archives.
You know, I think the interesting thing, one of the ways that they packaged this, if you will, to present this to Congress to make sure it got through, is they did that old ploy about, you know, rushing in and being the lead opposition and saying, well, we've got a way to fix this. But, you know, that's not good enough. They have to sell it, as it were. And one of the things that they told Congress was that they said, look, we are just as concerned as you are and as the American people are about the banking system. We feel we've got a way to fix this, so that people do not lose their money, and so that you know, this will ultimately protect the public. And isn't that really what we want to do here? Isn't that pretty much what they said?
Yeah, it's exactly what they said. They said it's time to take the risk out of banking, to protect the little investor, to make sure that the banks don't collapse and that the banks are regulated properly, mm-hmm. and in the public interest. And all the right phrases were used. But in the meantime, what they really were trying to figure out is how to maintain control.
Why don't you continue for just a minute while I put a couple of people on hold here in the other room. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, they were trying to maintain control. They knew that at this point in history, the banks in New York still had the lion's share of all of the investment capital in the United States. But as the country was expanding westward into the South, more and more banks were opening up in those regions, and proportionately, they were losing a little bit of share. And they could see that somewhere in the future, if they didn't put a stop to this trend, they would lose control over the financial markets of the U.S. And so they said, let's not wait for that to happen. Let's get control of the whole system so that we can regulate all of these new systems coming up, the new banks coming up in the South and in the West, and we'll do it in the public interest, the name of the public interest. We will be the regulators in the interest of the American people, and thereby control our own competition. And that's exactly what they did.
And guess what? They bought it.
Oh, yeah, the American people bought it because they used all the right phrases, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you're a student of these things and understand the mechanisms that are being used, it's pretty hard to be immune to these slick phrases.
Ed, we're coming up on a break. It's a very brief one. It's only 30 seconds long, and we'll be back with Truth. No, that was a couple weeks ago. The Creature from Jekyll Island. A second look at the Federal Reserve with my guest, G. Edward Griffin, here on The Big One. Along with my guest, G. Edward Griffin, the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, A Second Look at the Federal Reserve. Ed, we've got some more callers on the air. We are going to go through these callers. All I ask is that you keep it as brief as you possibly can so that we can get back with my guest. Charles from Naperville, delighted you called in. Say hello to Ed Griffin.
Hello, Mr. Griffin.
Good morning, Charles.
Just a moment, I'm going to take pride in saying that you are on this program, and this program this week is being conducted because of my adversarial views on this very subject that disagree with everyone in this listening audience. Right-wing fringe audience. But well, the reason I do is this, and I look at this occurrence, a secret meeting by rich people who got together who were the most concerned about the problem they were addressing in the world, and rightly so. I wouldn't want Joe Sixpack, who spends his Friday nights in a bowling alley at that meeting. I don't think that would be productive. So I think the right people were there for the subject they were addressing. I think it was secret because if it had not been secret, it would have, just the occurrence of the meeting would have driven the markets down, destroyed the banking system, and there would have been a run on the banks. Now, as far as spending a half hour telling us how secretly they went to the meeting, if you look around at the rich and famous today, they travel very much the same way. There's nothing unusual or about that. But I will give you that it was a conspiracy. For the reasons I just pointed out, it had to be a conspiracy. You couldn't put this out in the open before you did it. It would have destroyed everything. Now, here's the key test of whether they were good or bad people. What has happened during the last 90 years? Yes, we've had a little inflation. As we learned Friday from the guest, inflation is part of having a fiat system of money. But if you look at what's happened to this great country during that 90 years and the success of our economy and the stated purpose, if you read the Federal Reserve's stated purpose, not the conspiratorial purpose, is to control inflation, build growth in the economy, and keep employment up. Now, I would say if you look at the productivity and what we've done in this country in the past 90 years, you have to give them an A+. Now, they're not perfect. They make mistakes. They made one a couple of years ago when they when Greenspan raised interest rates absurdly high and then waited forever to bring them down. But if you look over the whole last 20 years, for example, we enjoyed the greatest stock market in the history of the world. We controlled inflation and we kept employment high. And Mr. Griffin, you have to admit that the Federal Reserve System had played a positive role. And that's my comment. Thank you for listening.
Chuck, I appreciate your calling in, and I mean that. Thanks very much. Yes.
Yeah, I'm delighted at Chuck's views here because it stimulates me to focus on some things that would normally not be brought up. First of all, Chuck's view is typically the elitist view of those who are in charge, typically the collectivist view. It says, well, you know, the people are too damn dumb to run their own lives. This country, we give them the vote, but we shouldn't let them really participate in their own political destiny. Those of us who are educated and who have money and who have the power, we should decide these things. And if we have to lie to people, if we have to have a conspiracy, so be it, because it's the only way things will work. This is the typical elitist view of collectivism. And this is the view of the people who are running the government today. And I'm saying that this is not a healthy view at all. In fact, this is the reason we're in very bad straits, in my opinion, in spite of what Charles has said. He said, the only argument I've ever heard is to oppose what I'm saying is the one that he just raised, which can be summarized as, well, we're doing well, aren't we? Look at how well we are living. So, therefore, it's okay to lie and to cheat and to steal from people. It's okay to take away their wealth and destroy their savings through inflation. It's okay to have events in Washington which are concealed from the voters. All of this is okay because we're living well, aren't we? I think it's a horrible argument.
The audio connection was lost at this point. Approximately 2 minutes is missing.
It's considered to be bad. In those days, if you wanted to loan money to someone, you were expected just to give it to them, and they were honor-bound to pay it back. And if they wanted to pay it back plus a little bit more, that was up to them. But you weren't supposed to come to a hard and fast agreement. It was supposed to be a thing of charity. All right, well, in today's modern world, the monetary systems are...
Ed, you've got 45 seconds. Go ahead.
Okay, well, how do I say this? I guess in today's world, we don't have that view. The idea that you should be compensated for letting someone else use your money is not considered bad in today's world. But what is considered bad is the amount of interest that is paid. Now, when you pay interest on nothing, that is considered usury, in my opinion. Interest on real money is okay, but interest on nothing is another issue, and that's what we'll be talking about after the break.
All right, and I'd just like to add one little tag on this thing to help further confuse people for right now. Is it, yeah, but wait a minute, you're saying fiat money, but I can go out and spend that money. I mean, so we'll get into that. Stay tuned, we'll be back with Ed Griffin at 9:05. You're listening to AM 1280, WBIG, Aurora, Naperville.